carried his body to the hospital, well, it's doubtful we'd be here having this conversation. Same goes if the terrorist cell had followed through with its plan, had Javon been turned loose, say, in Times Square on New Year's Eve, or South Central L.A. on a Saturday afternoon, or at the rededication of the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia this coming weekend, we would never have been able to contain it. Never. Now we are reasonably sure that there are more strike cells, each one likely to have one or more walkers. We know where one is. We have that under heavy surveillance. If there are others, we need to find and neutralize them. We have to do everything we can to locate and destroy these other carriers. If we don't, then we will have failed all of humanity. We may already be too late. He turned toward me, and his face was filled with a terrible and savage sadness. To stop this thing, I'd burn down heaven itself. I stood there, stunned and sick. Why the hell did you drag me into this shit? I brought you here because you have qualities I need. You are an experienced investigator with an understanding of politics. You can speak several useful languages. You have extensive martial arts training. You are tough and you are ruthless when it comes down to it. You've demonstrated that you lack hesitation in a crisis. Hesitation got our other teams killed. You're here because I can use you. I want you to lead my new team because my existing agents are being slaughtered and I need it to damn well stop. But why now? Why didn't you tell me this the other day when I auditioned for you?
Things have gotten worse, said Cortland. The other day we thought we had this under control, that we really had gotten a jump on it. We were wrong. We programmed Mind Reader to search all available databases for anything that might be related. One of the things we programmed it to find were cases of attacks involving biting.
Oh, crap. Church said, so far there have been 3 cases, all isolated, all in the Middle East. 2 in very remote spots in Afghanistan and 1 in northern Iraq. When you say isolated, I began, all 3 were identical. Small villages in remote areas that have natural barriers, mountains in 2 cases, a river and a cliff wall in the other. Each village was totally wiped out. Every single man, woman, and child was killed. Every body showed signs of human bites.
And what, the villagers were all walkers now?
No, said Cortland. Every person in each village had been shot repeatedly in the head. No other bodies were found.
What does that tell you? Church asked.
God Almighty, I breathed. The isolation, the cleanup afterward, it sounds like someone's been taking the walkers out for test drives.
The most recent one was 5 days ago, Cortland said.
Okay, I said softly. Okay.
This time they left a calling card, Church said. A video of the slaughter and a message from a hooded man. We're running voice recognition on it, but my guess is that it will be El Mujahid or one of his lieutenants.
The attack took place in a small mountain village called Bitar in northern Afghanistan, said Cortland quietly. Military authorities were tipped off to the attack but arrived hours after it was over. They found a tape that had been left for them on one of the bodies of the dead. Barrier intercepted it and was only fortunate enough to keep it from being generally released. We're lucky it wasn't posted on YouTube.
If you're in, Church said, then as soon as possible I want you to lead Echo Team in a quiet infiltration of the crab plant in Crisfield. That will put you and the members of your team in terrible danger. I make no apologies about it. I brought you here because I need a weapon, a thinking weapon. Something I can launch against the kind of people who would use something like Javad against the American people. He paused for a moment. The only people who have ever faced a walker and lived are in this room. So let me ask you, Mr. Ledger, he said softly. Are you in or not? I wanted to kill him. Cortland, too. I could feel my lips curling back and past the stricture in my throat. With a hiss in my voice, I said, I'm in. Church closed his eyes and sighed. He stood with his head bowed for a moment. When he opened his eyes, he looked 10 years older, but far, far more dangerous. Then let's get to work.
Chapter 32. British Army Field Hospital at Camp Bastion, Helmand Province, Afghanistan. 5 days ago. Of all of the British forces in Iraq, the 16th Air Assault Brigade had suffered the worst casualties. Their turnover of troops was steady, with fresh battalions moving into the field to replace those units that had suffered losses or had suffered too many days under the unforgiving Iraqi sun, which daily beat down at above 120 degrees. Wounded soldiers, British, American, and a mixed bag of other Allied troops were brought in with disheartening regularity. The triage process had taken on an assembly line pace. Get them in, stabilize the most serious wounds, check their IDs, and then airlift the worst cases out to hospital ships in the Gulf. Less seriously wounded were transported by helicopter or armored medical bus to bases scattered around the country, where they would remain on the chance that they might be rotated back to their units. Great Britain had diminished its presence in Iraq since 2007, and it was more politically useful to keep the same experienced troops in the country than to send in fresh ones. The serious cases would eventually be transported home to the Royal Center for Defense Medicine at Selly Oak Hospital in Birmingham. Too many of them would ultimately fall under the care of the British Limbless Ex-Servicemen's Association, who would try, and sometimes fail, to secure proper disability benefits for them and see them through rehab as they worked to find a new version of their civilian lives. Captain Gwyneth Dunn lived with these facts day after day. Running the British Army Field Hospital at Camp Bastion was like working a busy ER in one of the outer rings of hell. Or at least that's how she described it to her husband, who was stationed with the 1st Royal Anglian Regiment in Tikrit. She was a registered nurse whose training was in pediatrics, but the wizards at division had decided that this qualified her to triage battle-wounded soldiers. It was a total ongoing cock-up. She was at her desk in a Quonset hut that had two overhead fans that did nothing but push around stale hot air, reading through the computer printouts on the three wounded soldiers from the ambush near Najaf. Lieutenant Nigel Griffith, 23, Sergeant Gareth Henderson, 30, and Corporal Ian Potts, 20. She didn't know any of them. Probably never would. The door opened, and in walked Dr. Roger Coulson, the senior triage surgeon.
"What's the butcher's bill, Rog?"
Dunn asked, waving him to a chair. He sank down with a sigh, rubbed his eyes, and gave her a bleary look.
"It's not promising. The officer, Griffith, has a chest wound that's going to need more surgical attention than we can give here. The good news is that there's a pretty good Swedish chest cutter on HMS Hekla. I'm having him prepped for airlift."
"Does he have a chance?"
Dr. Coulson lifted one hand and waggled it back and forth.
"Shrapnel in the chest wall. We managed to reinflate the left lung, but he has some fragments near the heart. It'll take a deft hand to sort him out."
"What about the others?"
Coulson shrugged.
"They should both go out with Griffith. Corporal Potts is probably going to lose his left leg below the knee. Maybe the hand as well. We don't have a microsurgeon here, and they don't have one on the hospital ship either, so even if he keeps the hand, he'll lose most of its function, poor bastard."
He rubbed his eyes again, which were red and puffy from too many hours staring at wounds that he didn't have the staff or materials to properly treat.
"The best of the lot is Sergeant Henderson. Very bad facial laceration. He'll be disfigured, but the eyes were spared, so there's that.
I never met Henderson. He's a new lad. Transferred from the Suffolk Regiment.
Coulson said, indifferent to that part of it. Should have stayed in Suffolk and raised sheep.
You want him transported out? Dunn asked.
I should think so. Injury like that will take a long time to heal, and he looks like he might have been a handsome bloke. Injury of this kind will have traumatic personal effects.
Dunn looked down at the three printouts of the survivors spread out on her desk. She picked up Henderson's and examined the face of the 30-year-old sergeant from the farmlands.
He was a handsome lad.
She shook her head and turned the page over to show the doctor.
Ah, well, Coulson said sadly. It doesn't look like that any more. Pity the poor blighter.
Chapter 33. Baltimore, Maryland. Tuesday, June 30th, 3:12 p.m. As Church and Cortland led me through a series of hallways, I said, I'm going to take a flyer here and assume that you know that there is no way this prion thing is simply the weapon du jour of a group of religious fundamentalists.
No kidding, Church said.
The warehouse was very large, with suites of offices, workrooms of all kinds, and several big storage rooms. There were scores of jumpsuited workmen shifting crates, running wires, and swinging hammers. Guards patrolled the hallway, and every one of them looked like he'd had his sense of humor surgically removed. Not a lot of smiling in that place, and I could certainly understand why. I wondered how many of the people in the halls had lost friends at St. Michael's. "So the real reason you didn't hit the crab plant is because of what happened at St. Michael's," I said. "You're thinking that if the DMS's cream of the crop would fall prey to fatal hesitation, then anyone else would too. Even special ops."
"You'd make a bloody good terrorist,"
Grace said with an approving smile.
"I'm hoping he'll make a great terrorist," Church corrected and pushed through the door.
Grace Cortland gave me a wink as she followed. I wondered why her team was not being offered the job. Maybe they were still too shocked and too hot after what happened to their friends at St. Michael's. More likely, they were too valuable to throw away on what clearly could be a suicide mission or a trap. I didn't for a moment think the Church wouldn't be aware that I would think that, but it did give me a bit of a measure between what Church needed to get done and what he could spare compassion on. Big gap, probably getting wider every minute. Chapter 34. Baltimore, Maryland. Tuesday, June 30th, 3:16 p.m. We entered the main warehouse floor, which was big enough to be an airplane hangar. Back in the shadows, I could see a number of vehicles, mostly civilian, with a few military Hummers and transport trucks sprinkled throughout. There were two big storage bins lining one wall, one marked Equipment and the other Arms. A soldier with an M16 stood outside the arms locker, eyes slowly scanning the room, his finger laid straight along the outside of the trigger guard. One corner of the room had been turned into a makeshift training area with several hundred square feet of blue gym mats. The other candidates I'd tussled with, minus the clown I'd punched in the throat, were seated in the front row of an otherwise empty section of folding chairs. I could feel their eyes on me, and two of them gave me cautious nods, Sergeant Rock and the Jolly Green Giant. The latter held an ice pack to his face. Across from them was a second row of chairs, and these were filled with a dozen hard-looking men and women in fatigue pants and black T-shirts. No one wore any patch or insignia indicating branch of service or rank, but at least half of them had military tattoos of one kind or another. Church stepped onto the mats and gave each group a long, considering stare. Even in that vast room, he gave the impression of size and substance. All conversation ceased immediately, and every eye was on him. I've seldom encountered a more commanding presence, and though he was surely aware of the effect he had on everyone, there wasn't the slightest sign that he was jazzed by it. It was a fact of life to him, or, more probably, a tool. Grace and I stood at the edge of the training floor, she on the side with the dozen, her team, I presumed, and me closer to the four men I was supposed to lead. "Time is short," Church began.
so let's cut right to it. With the loss of Bravo and Charlie teams at the hospital, we are critically short-handed. Over the next 3 months, we will recruit and train at least a dozen additional teams, but that doesn't help us right now. He paused and looked at Grace's team. Echo team needs to build, train, and get to combat readiness ASAP. I expect each member of Alpha team to assist in any way possible. Grins began to form on the faces of some of the Alpha team bucks, but Church said, "Understand me here. If anyone, any single person, no matter what rank or MOS, does anything to interfere with the training process, whether by a harmless stunt or some kind of hazing nonsense, I will take it as a personal insult. It will be better for you to wake up in a room full of walkers, let me assure you." That wiped the smile off everyone's face. We all knew he meant it. And I was starting to get a pretty good idea that he was a total whack job. But he was our whack job. He turned to Echo Team. "Lieutenant Colonel Hanley has chosen to spend the rest of the day in intensive care. Apparently his larynx got in the way of his good judgment. Pity about that. He looked real broken up about it, too." Church pointed to me. "Captain Ledger is now your team leader, effective immediately. You will all offer him your very best support." He didn't add a cheesy "or else," but everyone heard it. He waited for questions. Perhaps "dared" is another word, and then beckoned me over. When I was within range for a quiet comment, I murmured, "Captain Ledger? I was only an E6 in the Army." "If Captain doesn't suit you, we can discuss it later." "Look, what's my brief here? Is this a hand-to-hand session? Do you have a curriculum you want me to follow?" "No, but in short, I need you to know their capabilities and their flaws, so that you know who to trust and at what moment." "With Alpha Team watching?" "Yes." I shook my head. "Not going to happen. If my guys are going to have to go in alone, then we train alone. Show them some respect." I was aware of having said, "my guys," and Church was aware of it, too. He smiled. "Fine, then." He signaled to Grace. "Captain Ledger will be using the gym floor. Take your team to the small arms range." She hesitated and then nodded, called to her team, and led them away. Church walked over to a chair on which was a stack of thick folders. He handed the top four folders to me. "These are the records for your team. They are the men who have the best overall qualifications and whom we could get on site in time to meet you. I have a few others on their way here from the field, but the earliest ETA from that group would be 30 hours. These other folders are possibles. I'm having them all brought in, and if you have time, I want you to review the candidates and make your selections." "Who do I have to clear them with?" He shook his head. "No red tape in the DMS, Captain. Your team. Your call." "Jesus Christ," I thought. "No pressure there." I said, "Listen, Church, since you yanked me out of my life and stuck me with this job, and since you seem to want to give me a lot of personal freedom of action and authority, I hope you're as good as your word when I want to do things my way." "Meaning?" "Meaning, as of this moment, there's the police department way, the federal law enforcement way, the military way, and my way. If you want me to function at my best, then you're going to have to accept that I'm going to have to make up some of my own rules. I don't know enough about your playbook, and quite frankly, I don't like the way you operate. If I'm not a cop anymore, then I'm something else. Something new." "Okay. Then from here on out, I'll decide what that is, and that includes building, shaping, and leading my team. My team, my rules." We stood there, like a couple of mountain gorillas, eyeing each other to see if this was going to be a fight or a collaborative hunt. He smiled. "If you're looking for an argument, Captain, you're wasting your breath and you're wasting your own training time." "Do I have to salute you?" I asked, keeping the smile off my face. "I would prefer not." "What about my job? I'm supposed to report back to work tomorrow, and I have to let someone know at the precinct. And my—" He cut me off. "If time allows, you and I can sit down and go over whatever details need seeing to. I'll even have someone go and feed your cat. All of that is beside the point. Right now, I need you to step up and be the team leader.
I want to see Rudy. Dr. Sanchez and I will have a talk first. You can see him later.
Can you tell me one thing at least?
Make it quick.
Who the hell are you?
When he didn't respond, I said, Will you at least tell me your first name? As far as you're concerned, it's Mister. Blindsiding this guy was never going to be easy. Have fun getting to know your men, Captain Ledger, he said. I'm sure they're all dying to get to know you better. With that, he turned and left.
Son of a bitch, I said softly, and turned to face my team.
Chapter 35. HMS Hecla, Royal Navy Hospital ship 4 days ago. The medevac chopper airlifted the wounded British soldiers from the field hospital at Bastion, across Pakistani airspace into the Gulf of Oman, where it touched down on the helipad at the stern of the HMS Hecla, a hospital ship, and an hour later the ship headed out of the Gulf into the Arabian Sea and steered west toward the Gulf of Aden, and then turned northwest into the Red Sea. Within 40 minutes of the transfer of wounded from the helicopter to the Hecla, Lieutenant Nigel Griffith was in surgery. Griffith survived the operation but coded in recovery. The ICU team brought him back once, then again, and finally Griffith's heart simply failed. Corporal Ian Potts was treated and made comfortable, but the doctors were already planning the amputations of his hand and leg. Of the third man from the ambush, Sergeant Gareth Henderson, it was later reported that he died as a result of head trauma. His death was observed and recorded by Nurse Rachel Anders and Dr. Michael O'Malley, both of whom were temporary medical staff from the Red Cross, coming off a 6-month volunteer stint aboard and expecting to transfer off the Hecla to join an international infectious disease medical research team stationed in the Great Bitter Lake region of Egypt. His body was wrapped in a body bag and transferred to the cold room in the ship's hold, along with 41 other corpses from the meat grinders in Iraq and Afghanistan. At 2:55 that morning, a second helicopter landed on the stern of the Hecla, and Nurse Anders and Dr. O'Malley boarded the chopper along with 4 very large wheeled metal equipment cases, drugs and medical supplies for the research team. The Hilo lifted off and flew east toward the lake. When it landed, Anders, O'Malley, and the 2 others were greeted warmly by the research team, all of whom were strangers, but each of whom were happy to have their team strengthened. O'Malley oversaw the unloading of the metal cases personally while Anders loitered outside the tent, smoking a cigarette, ostensibly relaxing after a harrowing tour. 2 men approached, a tall, sandy-haired man in a lightweight white suit, and a slightly shorter dark-haired man in dun-colored trousers and a polo shirt. The tall man bent and kissed her on both cheeks.
"It's good to see you, Rachel. I trust the flight was without incident?"
"Everything went well," she said, exhaling as she spoke.
"Jolly good."
The man gave her a wink and then slipped in through the tent flaps.
The shorter man lingered for a moment to survey the surroundings before following his companion inside. In the tent, the doctor looked up suddenly from behind one of the cases, but his face changed from alarm to pleasure instantly.
"You gentlemen are up and about early," O'Malley said, rising and extending his hand.
"Early bird and all that," the tall man said.
He nodded to the case behind which the doctor stood.
"Still snug in there?"
"I was just about to open it." "Ooh, I just can't wait," murmured the shorter man with asperity.
The doctor undid the locks and lifted the lid, then swung open the side doors so that the contents were revealed. Inside the case, a large man lay in a fetal curl, his head swathed in white bandages. He turned his face toward the newcomer and opened his eyes, which were red-rimmed with fatigue and pain.
"Sebastian," he whispered.
Galt smiled down at him and then extended his hands. Together he and Dr. O'Malley helped El Mujahid to his feet, while Toys hung back by the tent entrance and watched. He wore a smile, but it did not reach as far as his cold, cat-green eyes. The fighter was a little unsteady, and his bandages were stained with blood seepage, but for all that, he still exuded an aura of great animal strength. They helped him into a chair, and O'Malley set to work removing the soiled wrappings. The gash was ugly, and it disfigured the fighter's face. Galt privately thought that El Mujahid might have done too thorough a job because his lip had a sneering curl, proof that nerves and muscles had been damaged. All that had really been required was a disfiguring wound, but, he reflected, never tell a tradesman how to do his own job, and El Mujahid's job was mayhem and slaughter. He flicked a glance at Toys, who appeared to be mildly disgusted, but whether it was from the ugly wound or the man whose features it distorted was not clear. Galt figured it was both. O'Malley gave him a shot for the pain, though El Mujahid appeared not to need it, and he gave him vitamins, antibiotics, and a stimulant. When he had applied a fresh dressing, Galt thanked him and suggested the doctor join Nurse Anders outside for a smoke. Toys went with him. When they were alone, Galt pulled over a folding chair and sat down, bending close to the fighter.
"You did yourself quite a nasty, my friend. Are you sure you can complete the mission? There will be a lot of travel. Another helicopter, a ship, trucks, and all of it in a few quick days."
"That's enough to tire the average bloke, but with that injury—"
The fighter grunted.
"Pain is a tool. It is a whetstone to sharpen resolve."
Galt wasn't sure if that was a quote from Scripture, but it sounded good.
"The trigger device is already in the States," Galt said. "In a safe in the hotel room we've booked for you. The combination is Amira's birthday."
Galt looked for the flash of anger in El Mujahid's eyes, saw it, and mentally nodded to himself.
"Yes," he thought. "He knows about us."
It was something Galt had begun to suspect, but he didn't yet understand why El Mujahid was leaving the matter off the table. Aloud, he said,
"I suggest you leave it in the safe until the very last minute. We wouldn't want an accident, would we?"
"No," said the fighter in a soft voice.
"We wouldn't want that."
Toys stood just beyond the campfire light, lost in the deep black shadows cast by a stand of date palms. He was staring at the entrance to the tent where Galt and El Mujahid were deep in conversation. As soon as he had left the tent, his smile had vanished as surely as if some hand had reached into his mind and flicked off a switch. His features changed in the absence of observation. He became a different kind of creature.
"Amira," he murmured aloud, his lips curling into a feral sneer at the taste of the name.
Before Galt had met her, before he'd allowed himself to fall in love with that woman, his friend and employer had been perfect, brilliant, wonderfully ruthless, efficient, and inflexible. In short, beautiful. Now Galt was getting sloppy, and he was getting far too confident, overconfident. Against Toys's frequent cautions, Galt was taking unnecessary risks, spinning plans within plans, and all of it because of that mad witch.
"Amira," he said again. God, how he would love to see her bleed.
Chapter 36. Baltimore, Maryland, Tuesday, June 30th, 3:25 p.m. The four of them stared at me. Half an hour ago we were strangers and I was beating the crap out of them. Now I was supposed to lead them on an urban infiltration mission against unknown odds and, very likely, plague-carrying walking corpses. How could I open a dialogue with these men with all of that hanging in the air? Okay, I thought. If you're going to do this, buddy boy, then you'd better get it right the first time.
"Attention!"
They shot to their feet and snapped to attention with all the speed and precision of career military. I walked up to stand in front of them and gave them all a hard, steady look. "I don't make threats and I don't like speeches, so this one will be short. If you're here, then you know what's going on. Maybe some of you know more about this than I do. Whatever. You four are supposed to be the best of a good lot, all active military. Until this afternoon, I was a Baltimore police detective.
Church says that I'm a captain, but I haven't seen any bars on my collar or a paycheck with Captain Ledger on it, so it might still sound hypothetical to some of you. But from this point on, I'm in charge of Echo Team. Anyone who doesn't like it or doesn't think they can work with me can leave right now without prejudice. Otherwise, hold your line. You have 1 second to decide. Nobody moved a muscle. That's settled then. Stand at ease. I gave them a quick rundown of my military and law enforcement career, and then told them about my martial arts background. I wrapped it up by saying, I don't do martial arts for trophies or for fun. I'm a fighter, and I train to win any fight I'm in. I don't believe in rules, and I don't believe in fair fights. You want a fair fight? Join a boxing club. I also don't believe in dying for my country. I have a kind of General Patton take on that. I think the other guy should die for his. Any of you have problems with that?
Hoo-ah,
murmured Sergeant Rock, which was more or less Ranger slang for fucking A. We may actually be doing a field op as early as tomorrow. We don't have time for male bonding and long nights around a campfire telling tales and listening to a harmonica. They brought us on board to be field ops, first-liners and shooters. We're going to try a quiet infiltration, but if we get a kill order, then scared or not, we're going to put hair on the walls. When we lock and load, gentlemen, then those living dead motherfuckers had better start being scared of us, because, by God, sooner or later, we are going to wipe them out. Not hurt them, not slow them down. We are going to kill them. All. End of speech. I shifted to stand in front of Sergeant Rock. His dark brown skin was crisscrossed with scars, old and new. Name and rank.
First Sergeant Bradley Sims, U.S. Army Ranger, sir.
Sir. That would take some getting used to. Okay, Top, why are you here?
Serve my country, sir.
He had that non-com knack of looking straight through an officer without actually making real eye contact. Don't kiss my ass, why are you here? Now he looked at me. Right into me, and there were all kinds of fires burning in his dark brown eyes.
A few years ago, I stepped back from active duty to take a training post at Camp Merrill. While I was there, my son Henry was killed in Iraq on the third day of the war, 6 days before his 19th birthday.
He paused.
My daughter Monique lost both her legs in Baghdad last Christmas when a mine blew up under her Bradley. I got no more kids to throw at this thing. I need to tear off a piece of this myself.
For revenge?
I got a nephew in junior year of high school. He wants to join the Army. His choice if he enlists or not, but maybe I can do something about the number of threats he might have to face.
I nodded and stepped to the next man, Scarface. Name and rank.
Second Lieutenant Oliver Brown, Army, sir.
Duty?
2 tours in Iraq, 1 in Afghanistan.
Action?
I was at Debaka Pass.
That was one of the most significant battles of the Second Iraq War. I'd heard a general on CNN call it a hero maker, and yet the mainstream news barely mentioned it. Special Forces? He nodded. He did it the right way. Just an acknowledgement without puffing up with pride. I liked that. That's where you picked up the scar?
No, sir. My daddy gave me that when I was 16.
That was the only time he didn't meet my eyes. I moved on. Joker. Read it out, I said. CPO Samuel Tyler, U.S. Navy, friends call me Skip, sir. Why? He blinked. Nickname from when I was a kid, sir. Let me guess, your dad was a captain and they called you Little Skipper. He flushed bright red, hole in one. SEALs?
No, sir, I washed out during Hell Week.
Why?
They said I was too tall and heavy to be a SEAL.
You are. Then I threw him a bone. But I don't think we're going to be doing much long-distance swimming. I need sons of bitches that can hit hard, hit fast, and hit last. Can you do that?
You damn right, he said, then added, sir.
I looked at the last guy. Jolly green giant. He towered several inches over me and had to go 260. All chest and shoulders. Tiny waist. If for all the mass, he looked quick rather than bulky, not like Ape Man. One side of his face was still red and swollen from where I'd hit him.
Give it to me. Bunny rabbit,
Force recon, sir.
I shot him a look. You think you're fucking funny?
No, sir. My last name is Rabbit. Everyone calls me Bunny.
He paused.
It gets worse, sir. My first name's Harvey.
The other guys tried to hold it together. I have to give them that, but they all cracked up.
Son,
said Top Sims,
did your parents hate you? Yeah, Top, I think they did.
And then I lost it, too.
Chapter 37 Sebastian Galt, the Hotel Ishtar, Baghdad, 4 days ago. So many parts of Galt's plan were in motion now, and it was all going beautifully. Galt and Toys, together and separately, had been going on site to oversee the most critical phases, and it had been like taking a stroll in a summer garden. No one they knew could move around the Middle East with the freedom Galt enjoyed. Certainly no one in the military. Even ambassadors had 5 times the restrictions that were imposed on him. He, however, was unique. Sebastian Galt was the single biggest contributor in terms of financial aid and materials to the Red Cross, the World Health Organization, and 6 other humanitarian organizations. He had poured tens of millions into each organization, and he could say, with no fear of contradiction or qualification, that he had helped to ease more suffering and save more lives than any other single person in this hemisphere. Without benefit of a government behind him, with no armies, no overt political agendas, Galt, through Gen 2000 and his other companies, had helped eradicate 18 disease pathogens, including a new form of river blindness, a mutated strain of cholera, and 2 separate strains of TB. His comment at the World Health Summit in Oslo had first been a beauty of a soundbite, and had later more or less become the credo of independent health organizations worldwide. Humanity comes first, always. Politics and religion, valuable as they are always of second importance. If we do not work together to preserve life, to treasure it and keep it safe, then nothing we fight for is worth having. In truth, the wisest statement Galt had ever heard, and he heard it from his own father, was that everyone has a price. Good old Dad had added 2 bits of his personal wisdom as codicils to that. The first was, if someone tells you that they can't be bought, it's a matter of you having not offered the right amount. And the second was, if you can't find their price, then find their vice, and own that. Sebastian Galt loved his father. Damn shame the man had smoked like a furnace, otherwise he might be here to share in the billions, rather than lying dead in a Bishopsgate cemetery. Cancer had taken him in less than 16 months. Galt had been 18 the day before the funeral and had stepped right in as owner-manager of the chain. He sold it immediately, finished college, and invested every dime in pharmaceutical industry stock, taking some risks, acting as his own broker so that he saved his fees for reinvestment, buying smart and constantly looking toward the horizon for the next trend. Unlike his peers, he never bothered looking for the golden fleece pharma stock, the elusive wonder drug that will actually cure something. Instead, he focused on new treatment areas for diseases that might never be cured. It wasn't until well after he made his first billion that he even paid attention to cures, and even then it was cures for diseases that nobody cared about, things that affected tribes in third-world shitholes. If it hadn't been for internet news, he might never have even gone in that direction. But then he had a revelation, a major one. Cure something in the third world, take a visible financial loss on the effort to do so, and then let the internet news junkies turn you into a saint. He tried it, and it worked. It was easier than he expected. Most of the third world diseases were easy to cure. They exist largely because no major pharmaceutical company gives a tinker's damn about starving people in some African nation whose name changes every other week. When Galt's first company, Pharma Solutions, found a cure for swamp blight, a rare disease in Somalia, he borrowed money to mass-produce and distribute the drug through the World Health Organization.
The WHO, the most well-intentioned and earnest people in the world,
but easily duped because of their desperate need for support, told everyone in the world press about how this fledgling company nearly bankrupted itself
to cure a tragic disease. The story hit the internet on a Tuesday morning. By Wednesday evening, it was on CNN, and by Thursday midday, it was picked up by wire services everywhere. By close of business on Friday, Pharma Solutions stock had doubled. By the close of business the following week, the stock price had gone vertical. That was the first time Galt, then 22 years old, made it onto the cover of Newsweek. By the time Galt was 26, he was a billionaire several times over. He openly pumped millions into research and scored one cure after another. When he launched Gen 2000, he stepped into the global pharmaceutical arena for real, but by then he owned billions in stock in other pharma companies. The fact that at least half of the diseases for which he ultimately found a cure were pathogens cooked up in his lab never made it into the press. It wasn't even a rumor in the wind. Enough money saw to that, and so far his father, bless his soul, had been right. Everyone had a price or a vice. Toys was reading the London Times. He murmured. There's speculation, again, about your being given a knighthood, and another rumor about a Nobel Prize. He folded down the paper and looked at Galt. Which would you prefer? Galt shrugged, not terribly interested. The papers dredged that much up every few weeks.
The Nobel win would drive up the stock prices.
Sure, but the knighthood would get you laid a lot more often.
I get laid quite enough, thank you.
Toys sniffed. I've seen some of the cows you bring home.
Galt sipped his drink.
So how would a knighthood change that?
Well, Toys drawled, Sir Sebastian would at very least get some well-bred ass. As it is now, you seem to rate your playmates by cup size.
Better than the half-starved creatures you find so thrilling.
You can never be too thin or too rich, Toys said, quoting sagely. They were interrupted by the chirp of Toys's cell phone.
Toys looked at it and handed it over without answering.
The Yank.
Galt flipped it open and heard the American's familiar Texas drawl. Line?
Clear. Good to hear from you.
As usual, Toys bent close to listen in.
Yeah, well, the shit's hit the fan round here. We've all been scrambling. I've been in continuous meetings for the last couple of days. There's the matter of a tape from Afghanistan, an attack on a village. You follow me?
Of course.
You should warn me about shit like that, damn it. That set a lot of brush fires, and Big G has been trying to take over the whole show. There's been a lot of pressure to crowd the new team out.
The TMS?
He could almost hear the American flinch at the use of an uncoded word.
Yeah. The president wants them in, and everyone else wants them out, and I mean out, closed down.
Any chance of that?
None, far as I can see. For whatever reason, the president seems to be defending this group against all comers. I actually witnessed him read the riot act to the National Security Advisor in front of a couple of generals. It's getting ugly in D.C. I'm working on planning one of my guys in this group.
How sure are you that you can?
The American paused.
Pretty sure.
Toys raised his eyebrows and mimed applause. Galt said,
Keep me posted.
He closed the phone and set it aside. Toys walked back to his chair and settled into it, and the two of them considered the implications of the call. Toys said,
Perhaps I've been underestimating that bloke.
Chapter 38, Baltimore, Maryland, Tuesday, June 30th, 3:36 p.m. Okay, I said. So we danced a bit earlier. Is anyone too damaged to train? More to the point, is anyone too banged up to go into combat today or tomorrow, if it comes to it?
Well, my nuts still hurt,
Ollie said, then added,
Sir, but I can pull a trigger.
I'm good,
Bunny said. He tossed the ice pack onto the floor beside the mat. Skip winced.
Nuts for me too, sir. I think they're up in my chest cavity somewhere.
They'll drop when you hit puberty,
Bunny said under his breath. He looked at me.
Sir.
Skip the sir shit unless we're not alone. It's already getting old.
I can fight, Skip said.
I nodded to First Sergeant Sims. What about you, Top? Any damage?
Just to my pride. Never been blindsided before.
Okay, I nodded. Church wants Echo Team to be operationally ready to carry out an urban infiltration sometime in the next day or two. The last two combat teams were KIA by these walkers. I haven't seen the tapes yet, but they tell me those guys were at a full complement and fully trained. But because of the unknown nature of the enemy at the time, they became confused, and that caused hesitation, which proved disastrous. The five of us are supposed to be the new bulldogs in the junkyard. Sounds great. Sounds very heroic. But on a practical level, I've never led a team before.
As pep talks go, Coach, Bunny said, this one kind of blows.
I ignored him. But what I have done is train fighters. That I know I can do. So, because I'm the big dog, I get to teach you four to fight the Joe Ledger way. So far, the Joe Ledger way had involved them getting their asses handed to them, so they weren't all that eager to rush in. Not a raw team moment.
How exactly are we supposed to kill these walker things? Skip asked. They, being dead and all.
Try not to get bitten, son, Bunny said. That's a start.
In the absence of further info from the medical team, we'll proceed on the assumption that the spine and or brain stem is the key. Damage that, and you pull the plug on these things. I kicked the living shit out of the first one, Javad, and I might as well have been shaking his hand. But then I broke his neck and he went down. Seems reasonable that there's activity in the brain stem area. So for us, the new sweet spot is the spine.
Let me ask something, Skip said. The way you dropped Colonel Hanley, don't you think that was a little harsh?
Church said something that had me scared and pissed off. I told them about Rudy sitting there with a gun to his head.
Shit, Top said, stretching it out to about six syllables.
That's not right, Skip said. Maybe not, I admitted, but it put me in a zero-bullshit frame of mind. I don't play well with others when they get between me and what I want.
Yeah, said Bunny. I feel you.
Even so, Skip said, it reduced our operational efficiency by one man. Top answered that before I could.
No, it didn't. Hanley was a loudmouth and a showboat. He got mad and focused his anger on the captain as if he was a problem at hand. A man thinking with his heart instead of his head has stepped out of training. He'd get us all killed.
Yeah, Bunny agreed. The mission always comes first. Don't they teach you that in the Navy?
Skip shot him the finger, but he was grinning.
Chapter 39. The DMS Warehouse, Baltimore, 3:44 p.m. The four of them went to change out of civvies into the nondescript black BDUs that one of Church's people supplied. Correct sizes, too. Even for Bunny. I was about to head off to the bathroom to swap out of my clothes when I saw Rudy standing by the row of chairs, an armed guard by his side. I walked over to Rudy and we shook hands, then gave each other a tight hug. I looked at the guard. Step off. He moved exactly 6 feet away and stared a hole through the middle distance. I punched Rudy lightly on the shoulder.
You okay, man?
Little scared, Joe, but okay.
He glanced covertly at the guard and lowered his voice.
I've spent the last few minutes talking to your Mr. Church. He's...
He fished for an adjective that probably didn't exist.
Yeah, he is.
So you're Captain Ledger now. Impressive.
Ridiculous, too. He lowered his voice another notch.
Church took me on a quick tour. This is not some fly-by-night operation. This is millions of taxpayer dollars here.
I still don't know anything about how it runs. I've only seen two commanding officers, Church and this woman, Major Grace Cortland. Have you met her? Rudy brightened.
Oh, yes, she's very interesting.
Is that the shrink talking or the wolf in shrink's clothing?
A little of both. If I was crass, I'd make a joke about wanting to get her on my couch.
But, of course, you're not crass.
Of course not.
He looked around the room.
How do you feel about all this?
Borderline freaked. You?
Oh, I'm well over the border into total freak out. Luckily, I have years of practice at a professional appearance of calm tranquility. Inside, I'm a mess.
Really?
Really.
His smile looked frozen into place.
Church told me about St. Michael's and about that village in Afghanistan.
I nodded, and for a moment I had this weird feeling that we were standing there surrounded by ghosts.
And now you're working for them, Rudy said.
Working for them maybe isn't the right way to say it. It's more like we're both working against the same enemy.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend?
Something like that.
Church said that you might be leading a small team against these terrorists. Why not send the entire Army, Navy, and Marine Corps all at once?
I shook my head. The more feet on the ground, the bigger the risk of uncontrollable contamination. A small team wouldn't get in each other's way. There would be fewer instances where a soldier would be faced with the choice of whether to shoot an infected comrade. It simplifies things. And if worse comes to worst, and the infection has to be contained like it was at St. Michael's, then there are fewer overall losses of assets.
Assets? Rudy echoed.
People.
Dios mío, how do you know all this?
It's just common sense, I said.
No, he said. It's not. I wouldn't have thought of that. Most people wouldn't.
A fighter would.
You mean a warrior, said Rudy.
I nodded. Rudy gave me a strange look. Behind him, my four team members came filing in dressed in black BDUs. Rudy turned and watched as they walked over to the training area.
They look like tough men.
They are. He turned back to me.
I hope they're not so tough that they're hardened, Joe. We're not just fighting against something, we're fighting for something, and it would be a shame to destroy the very thing you're fighting to preserve.
I know.
I hope you do.
He looked at his watch.
I'd better go. Mr. Church is going to introduce me to the research teams. I think he's trying to recruit me, too.
Ha! That'll be the day. But Rudy gave me a funny look before he turned and headed back into the offices with the guard a half step behind him, rifle at port arms. I watched them until they passed through the far doorway.
Shit,
I murmured. I walked over to the team and had just opened my mouth to explain the first drill I wanted them to do, but I never got the chance, as behind us a door banged open and Sergeant Gus Dietrich came pelting into the room. Captain Ledger, Mr. Church wants you immediately. For what? I asked as Dietrich skidded to a halt. Dietrich hesitated for a fraction of a second, the new chain of command probably still uncertain in his head. He made his decision quickly, though. Surveillance teams found the missing truck. We think we found the third cell.
Where?
Delaware. He wants you to hit it.
When?
Now, said a voice, and I wheeled to see Church and Major Cortland striding across the floor. Training time's over, he said. Echo team is wheels up in 30.
Chapter 40. Claymont, Delaware, Tuesday, June 30th, 6:18 p.m. 4 hours ago, I was buying coffee for Rudy at a Starbucks near the Baltimore Aquarium, and now I was ankle-deep in shit and sewer water in a tunnel under Claymont, Delaware. Life just gets better and better. I was even wearing my street shoes, too. Once we'd gotten the go order, there was no time to find boots my size or change into fatigue pants. We all wore Kevlar chest protectors, limb pads, gun belts, and tactical helmets and night vision goggles. We had enough weapons to start a small war, which was pretty much the plan. We'd taken a chopper from Baltimore and offloaded in the parking lot of an abandoned elementary school near Route 13 near Bellevue State Park. Not a lot of foot traffic out that way. From there, we'd piled into the back of a fake UPS van borrowed from the local Vice Squad surveillance team, and they drove us around behind a liquor warehouse up the street from Selby's Fine Meats. We used the warehouse's cellar to access the storm drains, and from there into the main sewer line that was supposed to have a vent in the meatpacking plant. My handheld GPS tracker pointed the way. Ollie Brown was on point, and I liked the smooth way he moved, making very little noise despite the water. He checked his corners and kept his eyes pointing in the same direction as his gun sights. The big guy, Bunny, was our cover man, tailing us with an M1014 combat shotgun that looked like a toy in his hands, and in the bad light he looked like a hulking cave troll as he walked bent over, filling the tunnel. I was second in the string, with Top Sims and Skip Tyler behind me. I didn't have a silencer for my .45, so Sergeant Dietrich had loaned me a Beretta M9 with a Trinity sound suppressor and four extra magazines. I didn't have a long gun, though everyone else did. Handguns were always my thing. We moved like ghosts. No chatter. Just a line of men moving through shadows to face monsters. It was unreal. I felt like I was in a video game. Shame real life doesn't have a reset button. In the chopper, we'd sketched out what plans we could. "Here's a skinny," I said as we nodded our heads together over a map in the narrow confines of the chopper's cabin. "Church has en route to give us a thermal scan of the place, but that's about as much intel as we have. He's also arranging to have phone lines cut, and Major Cortland said that they'll get a presidential order allowing them to disrupt all cell reception in the area. We don't want one of the hostiles texting his buds on his LG chocolate."
"LOL," Bunny murmured.
"We'll come up through the sewers. We pulled up the schematics for the storm drains, and there's a big line that goes right under the plant, very nicely placed for a quiet walk-in once the lights are off. Questions?"
"Mission priorities?" asked Top.
"Mr. Church wants prisoners for interrogations. We'd all like more intel before we kick the doors on that crab plant. From all indications, that's going to be the big enchilada. The computer geeks think this meatpacking place is a storage depot for our hostiles, not a main action center."
"Does that mean taking a bullet to give him his prisoner?" Ollie asked, his eyes hard, challenging.
"No, but don't let it fall that way. Shoot to wound. Try to disable whenever possible, but don't get killed."
"High on my to-do list, boss," observed Bunny, and Skip nodded.
"What about those zombie motherfuckers?" asked Top.
"If we're lucky, the walkers will be in their containers locked up and on ice."
"And if we're not lucky?"
"If it doesn't have a pulse, Top, you have my permission to blow it all the way back to hell." They all nodded. It was the only part of the plan that they liked. I could see their point. In the annals of warfare, there was a long history of men getting killed because they lacked clear intelligence. We had jack shit. Before we boarded the chopper, I said, "Look, we don't know each other, and we haven't even had the chance to train as a team. Church is asking us to hit the ground running. Let's do just that. None of us are green at this sort of thing, so let's act and function like professionals. Chain of command is me, then Top. Everyone else is equal. We all watch each other's backs as well as our own. Five of us go in, five of us come out. We all clear on that?"
"Hoo-ah,"
Top said. "Who frickin' ah," agreed Skip. That was half an hour ago. Now we were in the sewers, and as we walked I had to fight to keep my whole attention on the matter at hand. If there was ever a better definition of too much too soon, I don't want to hear it. I wondered how unsettled the others were, and how that would affect them once things got hot. Ollie stopped, one fist raised, and we froze in place. He pointed to our 10 o'clock, and I saw the rusty iron ladder bolted to the wall. It was covered in moss and rat shit, and it ran up into a black hole in the ceiling. Thick, frigid white mist snaked down through a grill set into the concrete.
"Scope,"
I whispered to Skip, and he produced a fiberscope camera that was attached to the display screen of a miniature tactical video system. We clustered around and studied the screen display. It showed an empty room lined with stained metal tables. No movement, except for the mist.
"Must be cold as hell up there," Top said.
He glanced at me.
"Them walkers need to be kept on ice, right?"
"Let's hope so. But even if it's cold up there, let's not take anything for granted."
"Skip," I said, "up the ladder. Look for trips and traps." But after he was up there for a minute, he quietly called down.
"Clear. No electronics, just a padlock. I need the bolt cutters."
Bunny pulled them from his pack and handed them up. There was a sharp metallic snap, and then Skip was handing down the chain in sections. That was good news as far as it went, but it still spooked me. Anytime something is too easy, it isn't.
"Go, go, go,"
I hissed as one by one Echo Team climbed the ladder and took defensive positions inside the room. I went up next to last and gave the room a quick eyeball, but it really was empty. Just an old meat-cutting room with roller tables and hooks on chains, so that sides of beef or pork could be swung in on ceiling-mounted rails from the killing rooms. Then once cut, they would be rolled along the metal tables into an adjoining room for cleaning and packaging. Waste and blood was flushed down the floor gutters to the sewers. The function of the room was obvious, and I don't think any of Echo Team missed the irony of being in a room made for butchery. The mist was ankle-deep and clung to the floor, obscuring our feet. It stank of raw sewage and decay. The ambient temperature had to be right above freezing, although the air was oppressively humid. There were doors on either end of the room,